Well, we've covered on a wide range of topics here tonight.
I don't know what this is, the last one, but my name is Nick, and I attend St. James. It seems to me that the line between mental health and ill health can be very fine. And so I wondered if you could address the sorts of things that cause one to move from mental health to ill health. I mean, is it are there hereditary components, cataclysmic events like the job loss or divorce, poverty, as the gentleman spoke previously mentioned? And the reason for asking the question is to sort of start to think about how we could prevent these sort of occurrences.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that all of the things that you mentioned are important. So mental illness, depression as a model, so let's take that as the kind of more generic mental health, mental ill health, because it's the most common thing that people, you know, anxiety, depression, alcohol abuse, those would be the most common mental ill health things that are there in the community. Depression is probably kind of like pneumonia or some kind of, or heart disease or something like that. It's like the final common pathway of a number of different factors. So you can get heart disease because you have high cholesterol, you inherited, you have a bad diet, you don't exercise, you smoke cigarettes, you're stressed out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So depression is very similar to that. It's can be additive of all those factors, many different pathways that you get into it. So that makes it even more challenging to have a specific prevention program, because probably all the things that you do to stay well are going to be really important. Probably where it, what becomes the most effective strategy is to try and early recognize symptoms of stress or depression and be able to have access to treatments we talked about earlier online, or if your family doctor. Having those things early is probably the thing that we can do the best, and that's what the data would support. Because it's very different how you get there. Obviously, if you have a family history and you have had three people in your family that have ended up hospitalized or suicided or something like that, you're going to be very worried about that. If you had a family member, if your father was the classic story, father was alcoholic, you're just never going to touch a drop because you know that the rates of you're getting. So there is it's the genetic side, but I think in general it's very multifactorial, and mostly it's having a high incidence of, like a high suspicion for it, and then being able to respond kind of early when you can. I think that's what I would say.
Hi, Daisy. I'm a member of the Cathedral. The homelessness, down at the Hot House, about every 6 weeks they have speakers. The speaker came in, he was talking about homelessness, and he said they did an experiment in Toronto, and they took from the St. Mike's area, and they put these people in apartments, and they weren't paying for them because they didn't have addresses. Then they got money because they did have addresses, and they started to work. And the money they were saving through police and hospitals was enormous, and it was a huge success, and then Toronto stopped it. And that's the kind of thing, when this kind of thing is possible and the city knows that it works, why isn't it continued?
So the at-home study, that's what I was talking about here. That's exactly the study that I mentioned. I don't know the details of the... So my view would be, I'm not sure that the city stopped it. I'm not sure that that's true. I think that there was a grant that paid for this, and the grant finished up, and then the view was, as any kind of research, that the local jurisdiction should take that up and implement the program. So I think it's possible, and I don't know all the details, that maybe the city hasn't, and so you could say the city stopped funding it. I don't think that's quite accurate. I think, again, going back to my comments earlier, unfortunately, when you, depending on what time of history you are and what's on the kind of radar, unfortunately, issues like this kind of fall a little bit lower. Implementing is really expensive. It was a really expensive study. It takes a lot of time and effort. So it is very troubling. And mental health has a history of that, of finding treatments and then they're not getting adopted because they're too expensive to do, and then they kind of fall off. And that's really been a problem. And some of the examples I told you about childhood cancer, that never seems to fall off, right? And I'm not trying to suggest we shouldn't do that, but that's a great example where people, there's buy-in and support from many different levels, and those things keep going. And in mental illness, we haven't had the kind of advocacy or support that we need to keep these things going. And there's many people in my profession that think that advocacy piece is really where we need to work, so that what you just described wouldn't happen, because there are people that are there and making sure that it doesn't go. So I think that's more, maybe a little more, it's a little more nuanced than maybe that description earlier.
Hi, I'm John, a newish convert to St. James Cathedral. I wanted, first of all, just to thank you for an absolutely wonderful and generous presentation.
Thank you, John.
Secondly, two things that I thought were really interesting. One is, it was wonderful to hear you talk about no difference between mental health and health and ill health, and mental illness and illness. I believe that, and like just about everyone I suspect in this room, I've dealt with mental illness in the family. One of the things I learned at Massey College from historians, from the interdisciplinarity of it, was a historian who told me that in the Jesuit relations of the first contacts with the Aboriginal population, indigenous population of the country, they studied the three-step method, the primitive three-step method of good health in the community. The first step was herbal remedies. The second step, if that didn't work, was to the sweat lodge, to just sweat whatever it was. And if that didn't work, they were wrapped up in something and hurled into a totally freezing river, which was as close to shock treatment as I think they could find. And he finished the account of this primitive three-stage treatment saying they haven't even heard about bleeding. And so I think one of the things that we've had to go all the way back all these years, including maybe even medicine a bit, is to learn, A, to stop persecuting the First Nations, B, to learn from them and not condescendingly, not look patiently at some of their systems, because they still have a lot to teach us. And I think that was what I heard in what you were saying, and I thank you for that.
Thanks, John. I think that's we learn a lot about a holistic approach when we look often at longer standing cultures, less quotes developed, to use our white perspective. I think a lot of it has been very holistic, and the shaman, was always did lots of psychiatry as well. Like a lot of psychiatry comes from that. You didn't have a separate mental health shaman, where you had it was the whole thing for all of your health things. And and there's examples, and you'll know from Ned Shorter and others, there's examples of different psychiatric syndromes since the beginning of time, which are in many different populations and lots of very specific treatments. The other part of it is starting with a three-step approach, and that's what we've missed so much in our system, is having that psychotherapy for people that get with early depression or anxiety. Just get in there and get people well early, and that's, we really need to do that. And we are way behind compared to some of our other jurisdictions in Europe, for instance, in terms of doing it. We are way behind, and we will do much better by doing that. So thanks for bringing it. Well, thank you. Yeah.
My name's Elizabeth, and I taught teenagers for almost 40 years. Lucky me. It was a great privilege. I'm going back to an earlier comment about exercise. I taught private school, which it was a great privilege. But the mind and the body, just terribly important together. It really concerns me now when you hear about education, the cutbacks that are always happening. Please, let's do something about this. I remember when I was teaching, they cut back in the high schools. They only had to get one credit for phys ed. So you could take grade 9 phys ed, and then you wouldn't have to do it the rest of the time. I taught private school. They insisted they had to take phys ed through to grade 12, which a lot of people didn't want to do, but it wasn't a bad idea. And same with arts programs, all things to do with the mind and the body. And I think it's terribly important that we try and maintain this sort of momentum. It's very well, it's all very well for private school kids. They can, you know, it can be paid for, but we need to politically do something about it. And, you know, let's try and keep these links going. You know, you talked about things in the beginning. We're talking about our children and, you know, their health. Look at the way they don't walk to school anymore. You know, everything, you have to be driven because it's not safe. And they're spending so much time on machines and IT and not sleeping properly and all this kind of thing. I mean, I'm trying to be optimistic, quite frankly, but I find it difficult. I don't know, do you agree with me? I mean, this... good luck is what I say, but can we, the psychiatrists, sort of work on that as well?
So I think that's a great place for us to end, if you're okay. And on a I know you're absolutely right, and but you know what? These things creep up on you, and you realize you. I always find myself feeling like I'm talking as if I'm really old when I start looking back on the good old days, the good old days were getting a long time ago. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there really feels like there's been a generational shift away to kind of an investment that we all had in the kind of the social determinants of health. I think people see it, and our young people want to do it. And hopefully they're going to be able to choose to be able to do that and put the resources there, and we'll give them as much guidance as we can. But you're absolutely right. And if you have more resources and more money, life is generally easier in some ways. It doesn't prevent you from necessarily getting mentally ill, but it seems like it would be easier than not having it. So
there is something about Anglicans and worship, as you've been talking all night, Trevor, and clearly the number of questions coming from this group that we could keep going till the end of the day. But I've really appreciated your listening to the questions and answering them in such a holistic way. There is something about the Anglican worship and the way that we gather that we don't really quite understand. We can explain the bits and pieces of worship that we like for ourselves, and it's quite particular. But there is something about coming together, sometimes as perfect strangers, sometimes as close friends. There are very few places in the world left where you've got everybody in the room, from the prince to the pauper, from the employed to the unemployed, from the elderly to the very, very young, that learn this choreography. That is partly about mindfulness. It's partly about meditation. George Black, I know I've mentioned this before, but George Black used to say when we sing hymns, actually what's most important is that we're breathing together. You're moving and breathing as one large group of people and becoming one as you're singing. Some of us sing better than others, but it doesn't matter because we are in the practice of it. That we are making an altar call as Anglicans every single Sunday. It's not left to the Baptists who get to make the altar call. We actually do it every week. There's a mindfulness in being able to leave your pews and being able to offer yourself and to receive coming from the outside and from the inside. And that you're doing it with other people. I've often said that some folks are just dragging in the front doors on a Sunday morning because their lives are absolutely falling apart. And the person sitting next to you is having the time of their life and the best week of their life. I've always said, if you are having the best week of your life, for heaven's sakes, sing for the person who's having the worst week of their life. There's something about coming together as a body that is so powerful and rich, knowing that, in fact, God has summoned you to come to worship on that particular day. God has pulled you in. And that you are doing worship not for yourself. You're really doing it for the person next to you and being present to God, who's going to open you in a way that you didn't really realize. It's kind of like rebooting your system. Sometimes it's like being thrown into a cold river because we hear something, whether it's in the music or it's in a sermon, or it's the way you were greeted at the door, that you knew you needed to hear that one thing. It's like cognitive therapy for an hour and a bit, where you start to rethink how you actually are within the body of Christ and how you hear from the pulpit how God is present and loves you. In many ways, poverty comes in so many different forms. You can be in the biggest house and still feel homeless. You could be surrounded with the greatest of comfort and feel more isolated than anybody you know. And that's where the great equalizer for me is about our spirituality and how we gather on a Sunday morning or through the week in small groups or large groups, where we get to sing for our lives and we get to sing for our supper. And then we get sent out again to start it all over. When I think of, for me, when I think of empty pews, I think of folks who didn't really think about coming to worship as one place where they could find some wholeness. But the pews are filled with people Sunday by Sunday. You know what you receive for your own mental health and well-being. And that is a form of evangelism, that you get to go out and invite people in to say, I think you may find a home here. You may find a new breath here and find a way of being able to pull some of the bits and pieces of your life together. Just try it. Come, and I'll teach you how to dance. So on that note, from one Anglican to the next, a psychiatrist to a priest, and it's really helpful to know that the third gospel was written by a doctor, Luke, the physician. Because they actually go together. Thank you for being here tonight and all of your wisdom of the ages, and we'll invite you back for part 2.